This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Before we get to the startling news about rapid sea level change events, let's find the background on how this strange planet really works. Our first guest invented the formula that determines the relationship between glacial ice cover and sea level in any climate, including our future. Sometimes my curiosity backs me into corners much deeper than I am. Of course, that is why we call on world experts to bail us out. This time, I was reading an article in the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution, which claimed that melting glaciers are causing havoc. More perplexing, glaciers that vanished over 10,000 years ago will add to the rising seas of climate change in some places, but bring falling seas in others. Of course, that's a global denier's dream. You know, the seas are actually falling. How could Al Gore be right? But come on, does the Earth's crust have an active memory? That's what we need to know. And that was a good article by Jenny Chin that I read in September 2016. But who could straighten out those mysteries of ghost glaciers? The article points to a Canadian scientist who founded a way to measure and predict all that, and we're using what he found. Dr. Richard Peltier is a man with many titles. Located in Canada, he's professor of physics at the University of Toronto. Peltier is the director of the Center for Global Change Science. He has been the principal investigator of the Polar Climate Stability Network and the scientific director of something called SciNet. Peltier is a man who looks inside things like waves moving deep inside the ocean and the physics of planetary interiors. Despite his pivotal role in global research into glaciers, he prefers to be called just Dick. Dick Peltier, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Glad to talk to you.
I appreciate your sharing this time. I really do. Let's start with New England, where we have lots of listeners. Anybody who lives near the shore there knows it's changing because the sea is rising, but it's rising faster in New England than in some other places around the world seaside. Why is that?
Well, there are several reasons for this. I mean, probably the most important one is that the entire East Coast, including the New England region, is subsiding. That is, the surface of the land is sinking into the sea, not as a consequence of the action of global warming causing the expansion of ocean water and thus rising sea levels, and not because of the current continuing loss of mass from the great ice sheets at the poles, but simply because Canada, at the maximum of the last ice age, was covered by an over 4 kilometer thickness of grounded ice. And while this ice was in place, it pressed the surface of the Earth down under it, and this caused the land outside of the ice-covered region to be uplifted to produce what we call a proglacial forebulge. Since this massive ice cover was lost from Canada, the Canadian landmass has been rising out of the sea, and the entire U.S. East Coast has been sinking into the sea. So a very large contribution to the rise of sea level everywhere along the U.S. East Coast, including New England, is associated with this process of what we call proglacial forebulge collapse.
Well, that's not good news for New York and New Jersey when the next storm surge comes.
No, it certainly isn't. And that region of the coast, closer probably to Baltimore, in fact, is the region where the amplitude of this proglacial forebulge was largest. And its collapse is currently contributing on the order of a millimeter per year, every year, to global sea level rise, not associated with the ongoing process of global warming, but rather associated with the influence of the last ice age.
I don't think we're going to get too deep into this topic without learning one key phrase, which is glacial isostatic adjustment. Can you explain for the layperson what that is?
Surely. Basically, when there is a large mass of ice imposed on the surface of the planet, and I spoke earlier of this roughly 4 kilometer thickness of grounded ice that covered Canada at last glacial maximum, if this ice is resident on the surface of the planet for long enough, and here I'm speaking of times which are longer than a few thousands of years, In fact, this last ice age occurred over a time scale of 100,000 years. And given the presence of the ice, initially, the land beneath the ice is pressed downwards by a perfectly elastic effect that is an almost instantaneous reaction to the load of ice. But as this ice is continuing to reside on the surface, eventually the interior of the planet begins to flow as if it were a liquid at a rate which is determined by the effective viscosity of this solid, which is behaving as a liquid. Matter flows out from under the region that was ice-covered into the periphery, causing this forebulge region to be elevated. When the ice disappears, the reverse process occurs. Material begins to flow back under the once ice-covered region, causing the surface of the solid Earth to be uplifted. So if you look today, for example, in the Hudson Bay region of Canada, which was near the center of ice cover during the last ice age maximum, what we observe is that sea level is actually falling in the Hudson Bay region at the rate of about 1.5 centimeters every year. Or put it another way, the land is uplifting with respect to the sea at the same rate, about 1.5 centimeters every year. This rebound effect is the effect that is associated with the glacial isostatic adjustment process.
Yeah, I think I read that somewhere in Alaska somebody managed to open up a new golf course on the foreshore because some new land appeared for them.
Well, Alaska is a little bit of a different story, in fact, because the Alaska region is one in which the sea level is very strongly affected by earthquake-related processes, right? The entire coastline of Alaska has been subjected over the past many, many thousands of years to extremely intense what we call dip-slip earthquakes, which cause a very profound response of the surface of the solid Earth with respect to the sea as well, effects which have nothing to do with the glacial isostatic adjustment process, but rather with basic seismic processes.
And what about Britain and Scandinavia? They were under heavy ice loads. Are they rising now?
Yeah, I mean, Britain and Scandinavia, very closely related processes. In fact, the northern part of Britain, Scotland, and the contiguous regions across the North Sea of Norway and Sweden, that entire region at last glacial maximum was covered by a single sheet of ice, grounded ice, that connected these regions together. The southern part of it, England, in fact, was not ice covered. And at that time, at glacial maximum, the entire English Channel was dry land. That is, there was a land bridge that basically connected the southern part of the UK to the continent directly.
This makes me think about Brexit not really working at that time. But anyway, all right.
No, they were even more intimately connected than they have been in the past decades.
Well, now, Dick Peltier, you solved a basic problem of mapping out how this whole legacy of past ages operates. Could you tell us as novices about your system?
Well, the methodology that I've developed to help understand the connected issues of glaciation history and relative sea level history is a mathematical problem that's actually very closely connected to issues that have been solved prior to my becoming involved in this area by seismologists who are interested in the elastic, what we call elastic gravitational free oscillations of the planet, the ringing of the Earth, if you like a bell, which is caused when a massive earthquake occurs. What I'd been able to do was to take the basic theoretical structure that has been used to explain this ringing of the Earth bell, which occurs subsequent to major earthquakes, and to recast it into a form which enables a detailed description of the variations in the shape of the Earth and the history of local sea level by solving a complicated equation that I call the sea level equation. And this was accomplished basically in the mid-70s and 80s, and since that time, the theory has become further elaborated, much more detailed, and able to explain a wide variety of different observations that are connected with the ice age related deformations of the shape of the planet that have occurred as a consequence of glacial loading and unloading. And the theory is now being applied to help us to understand the sea level history that is being caused by the global warming process as it leads to a continuous diminution of the ice cover on Greenland and Antarctica, for example. So the theory has come to have a very, very wide application.
So we can go forward and backward with it. We could also help reconstruct past climates.
Yes, in fact, one of the major applications of the theory now, and it's one which my own group is very deeply involved in, is using the theory to determine what the boundary conditions of the planet were in terms of ice cover, in terms of the varying bathymetry of the ocean that was caused by the growth of these massive land ice complexes. So what we're doing is using the theory to produce boundary conditions for times in the past that reach back through the most recent 100,000-year ice age cycle. And what we're doing is taking these boundary conditions and using them in the context of modern climate models, the same models that are used to simulate the global warming process, so that we can reconstruct what climate would have been like at these past times. And the work has led to some very, very interesting explanations for observations that had never been explained previously.
And there have been a series of reconstructions called ICE 3G up to 5G, and now I guess coming 6G.
7G was published about 2 months ago.
What are they?
Well, these are basically models of the variation through time from about 30,000 years ago until the present of the changing ice cover on the planet, the changing paleotopography of the planet with respect to sea level, and the changing level of the sea everywhere throughout the global ocean basins as a function of time from about 30,000 years ago until the present. And each of these, each new edition, if you like, of the model, the global model, is driven typically by new discoveries of data that hadn't previously been assimilated into the theoretical structure. So we keep revising the model, improving the model continuously as new data become available. The most recent model, the 6GC model, is basically being employed internationally now in the context of what's called the Paleoclimate Model Intercomparison Project, in which the boundary conditions that I provide are being exercised by basically all of the global climate models that are employed in making global warming predictions of our future as a means of determining how accurate these models actually are. That is, by testing them outside of the region of parameter space, we call it, outside of the region in which they've been tuned to enable them to make global warming projections. So this whole process is playing a critical role now in our understanding of the climate system as a whole.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org. Our guest is Professor Richard Peltier from the University of Toronto, Canada. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. I'd like to draw on your other research domains of climate change in the Arctic to explore what I see as a parallel problem. A few years ago, UK geohazards expert Dr. Bill McGuire published his book, Waking the Giants, and he said land rising from the weight of glaciers triggers already existing fault lines into more earthquakes or volcanoes, into eruptions. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, that's been a topic that's been exercised a lot over the past roughly 20 or 30 years. The notion that the rebound of the crust due to the unloading of these massive ice complexes that existed at glacial maximum could be today responsible for triggering new earthquakes. I should say that this whole topic is very seriously debated on both sides of the issue. It's proven to be very difficult to actually discover, with the possible exception of Scandinavia, of Norway and Sweden, evidence for the occurrence, unambiguous evidence for the occurrence of this deglaciation-induced seismicity idea.
Can glaciers actually sort of cap off or diminish the possibility of volcanoes that exist under the ice? We've just seen an example of one going off in Iceland, and there was a discovery recently of a chain of volcanoes under Antarctica. Is the ice a factor in suppressing those?
I think in Iceland it's quite conceivable. Again, the arguments have been presented on both sides of that issue, but clearly the Iceland case is a very, very special case because Iceland sits on the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, right under a hot spot, if you like, an upwelling of hot material out of the interior of the Earth. And it gives rise, of course, to intense volcanism on Iceland episodically. You know, whether there has been any significant role played in that volcanism by variations in the ice cover over Iceland itself is really very difficult to establish in an unambiguous way.
Changing horses here, we love to watch the waves on the ocean, but you track waves that move below the surface. I didn't even know those existed. Could you tell us what's going on down there?
Well, this is an extremely interesting area, and it's one which is, in a way, closely connected as well, or at least connected, to this issue of global climate change associated with ice age processes. Let's talk just for a minute about the modern ocean and the interior wave field which exists throughout the volume of the modern ocean. That wave field, we believe, is very strongly produced, in fact triggered, by the motion of what we call the barotropic tide, the roughly 12-hour periodic tide that exists in the volume of the oceans and which corresponds to motions, horizontal motions of seawater right down to the base of the ocean at very slow rates, but in a highly periodic fashion. So the motion of this water over bottom topography in the ocean gives rise to waves which are called inertia gravity waves. And collectively, these waves are referred to as an internal tide. So they are a consequence of the astronomically forced tide, but they constitute an addition on top of that astronomically forced tide, which consists of this family of internal waves. The interest in these waves is that when they break, and they do break rather like ocean waves on a beach, they produce a mixing of the interior fluid of the ocean. And this mixing basically affects or causes or forces a vertical flux of mass in the internal body of the major ocean basins. And it's this vertical flux of mass caused by mixing associated with breaking of the internal tide that enables the very cold, salty, deep water that forms at the poles of the planet to rise up from the interior, right? And to complete what we call the overturning circulation, meridional overturning circulation of the oceans, or MOC, M-O-C. This meridional overturning circulation of the ocean has a huge impact on climate. And so the study of this internal wave field, this field of inertia gravity waves, has come to be a very sharp focus of work in physical oceanography globally.
Well, aside from climate, I'm gathering from what you say that internal ocean waves could help feed living things if they're causing an upwelling and also help, well, you're talking about the distribution of oceanic heat.
Yeah, the upwellings, of course, are associated with, rather than simply with the wave field in the ocean, with the nature of the circulation of the oceans itself. These upwelling zones, of course, are highly productive. And, of course, when you think of the equatorial Pacific Ocean, right off the west coast of South America, for example, during El Niño Southern Oscillation events, when the upwelling of cold water adjacent to the west coast of South America basically ceases, there's a massive impact, of course, on ocean productivity locally. The Peruvian anchovy harvest, you know, is one of the things to which we, you know, typically point in looking at the way in which time variation of this component of the ocean circulation impacts ocean productivity.
Getting back to the inside of things, we walk around on the crust, that is the Earth to us. What is the mantle, and does what happens there affect us?
No, absolutely. The mantle of the planet, broadly speaking, is the region from about roughly 3,000 kilometers in depth, about halfway to the interior, to the center of the Earth, up to the surface, or up to about 100 kilometers below the surface, right? So this region is solid, whereas the core of the planet, or at least the outer core of the planet, is liquid. So this solid part of the planet is the part of the planet which is able to flow as if it were a liquid when a stress is applied to it on a sufficiently long time scale, such as during the glacial loading and unloading process. So this mantle of the Earth is the region which is probed by the glacial isostatic adjustment process. And we can use this glacial isostatic adjustment probe to determine what the effective viscosity of the interior, the solid part of the interior of the planet, is. And this is proven to be the most powerful means of our establishing quite precisely what the value of that viscosity is. Of course, the mantle is also involved, rather like the oceans, in fact, in a circulation of its own kind, right, of its own region, which is associated with the thermal convection process. The fact that the core of the Earth, again about halfway down to the center by radius, the core mantle boundary, we call it, is at a temperature of between 3,000 and 4,000 kelvins. It's extremely hot. And because the difference in temperature between that boundary and the outer boundary of the planet itself is so large, the entire mantle is caused to convect like a liquid, rather like water in a pot which is put on the stove and heated from below. So there's an intense convective circulation in the mantle that is occurring on very, very long timescales, and it's that circulation which is responsible for the continental drift process, for plate tectonics, and all of the processes that are associated with plate tectonics. So there is a very deep connection, if you like, between the glacial isostatic adjustment process and the manner in which analyzing this process enables us to infer what the effective viscosity of the mantle of the Earth is, and the mantle convection process, which to explain physically requires knowledge of the effective viscosity of the interior. In my own work has actually demonstrated that the viscosity of the mantle that we infer on the basis of glacial isostatic adjustment analysis is precisely the viscosity which is required in the theory of the mantle convection process in order to explain plate tectonics. So there's a very deep connection between these two modes of motion, if I can call them that, of the solid outer part of the planet, which we refer to as the mantle.
Do you think that climate change has already diverted what might have been the next ice age?
Well, that's also that's also a very interesting comment. Short answer is yes, probably, although the timing of what would have been the onset of the next 100,000-year ice age cycle, right, is not precisely known, even though for the last million years, this 100,000-year ice age cycle has been an almost metronomic occurrence, right, in the history of Earth's climate variability. The magnitude of carbon dioxide that we've released into the atmosphere since the beginning of Northern Hemisphere industrialization is sufficiently strong, even now, to have strongly inhibited any tendency of this 100,000-year ice age cycle to continue. And so the probability of its continuation, given the continuing rise of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, very highly unlikely.
Dick Pelche, from your long career studying multiple fields, what concerns you most about our future?
Well, I mean, I think the concern we all have for the impact on planetary habitability that's associated with the global warming process that's caused by greenhouse gas increase is probably the greatest challenge that human civilization has faced since its rapid evolution, beginning probably around the middle of the last of these 100,000-year ice age cycles. This is an absolutely crucial issue which the global political system has yet been unable to come together to formulate a clear collective response. And I'm saying this even in the face of the Paris Climate Accord that was signed in 2015, late 2015. It's beginning to look as though the possibility that we will live up to the commitments under the Paris Accord are highly in doubt. And this is a huge concern to all of us who, you know, have a genuine desire to see to the continuing viability of human habitation. This is a huge concern to us all, whether the international community will ever be able to come together to take the collective action that's needed is highly questionable at present.
You know, there are some scientists who suggest that geoengineering could preserve what's left of the Arctic ice cap, and that might be necessary to preserve a livable climate. I'm not so sure. I am sort of a doomster. I think we're headed into that ice-free state that Earth has had for many millions of years in the past.
Well, you know, there was an interesting CBC piece done last night, actually, on the news on exactly this issue of geoengineering. The difficulty with all of the several different geoengineering solutions that have been suggested is that they normally would involve a catastrophe should they fail. And the probability of failure for any one of these geoengineering solutions, I would argue, is extremely high. So there's no answer from my own perspective to the problem of what we should do other than beginning to take dramatic steps to curtail greenhouse gas emissions. I'm very, very dubious that any of the geoengineering solutions that have been suggested could ever work.
What should science undergrads look for as the next important research frontier?
Oh, dear. Now, that's a very broad question. Well, this area, I think, is one that is going to continue to attract scientific attention of many of the brightest young people that are considering careers in science. But in the general area of the overall area of scientific research, of course, there are many different avenues of development which are occurring simultaneously, you know, including deep learning and its application basically to all areas of science, including the environment.
We've been speaking with Dr. Richard Peltier, professor of physics at the University of Toronto and head of other scientific initiatives. His system of measuring deglaciation and its impact is used by scientific bodies all over the world. Find links to follow up further in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Dick, thank you so much for educating us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure to talk to you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.